of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And joining me this week is an old friend. And, it, well, you know, about as old as he can be, because he's still very young. It's my old friend, Ryan S. Murphy. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Hi, I'm glad to be here. It's great to be on, finally be on the podcast.
I call Ryan an old friend because I have known Ryan since he was a little kid. I don't mean to embarrass you, Ryan, but I worked with Ryan.
It's all right.
I worked with Ryan's dad back when I did web design. His dad, Sean, one of my favorite people in the world. And ever since I met Ryan, when he was, again, when he was a little kid, he was into movies. He was, like, really into movies. And it was surprising for a kid his age to be into his movies as much as he was. And I remember thinking about this you reminded me of me. You know, because it was like you were just into it way, way advanced than someone your age normally would be. So, like,
How many 9-year-olds browsing the classic section of West Coast Video?
Not many, not many. And so I just want to ask you a little bit about, like, how did this all get started for you? I mean, what started it?
Well, I think part of it was just a certain amount of exposure to it as a kid. You know, I would just, like, watch movies on, you know, on Turner Classic Movies or something. And from a young age, I think because I watched them from a young age, I was just used to it. A lot of people, if they start watching movies when they're older movies, when they're a bit older, they have trouble getting into it because they're just not used to seeing that type of movie.
Right. Black and white. What's this?
Right, right. And, I mean, you know, it's very cliche thing, but when I was 7, I saw Star Wars for the first time. That was when they did the re-release, the special edition.
Right.
I won't get into the controversy of that, but that kind of hooked me in a big way. And so I kind of just started to explore more. I remember asking to see when I was a little kid. I remember asking to see, like, the original, or at least one of the early ones. I think it was the Tyrone Power Zorro movie.
Mm.
And so I remember at that point my dad was like, really? I remember being a little surprised. But so that was part of it. And then, you know, as I got older, you know, you start to realize, oh, like, this is actually something that people, this is their job. You know, they can actually, you can work on movies, which, you know, when you're really little, you don't think about as much.
Sure. Yeah. You're just right. They just get made somehow.
Yeah, yeah. So, and then I remember, because I was very into Lord of the Rings, and I had the extended editions, and on those they had these really, really in-depth documentaries. I remember watching those, and that was sort of when I realized, like, oh, a lot of people work on these things. These are, you know, very, these are huge productions with hundreds of people working on them, and so that kind of got me more interested in getting into the film industry.
Well, right. That was something else I wanted to get into, is that, you know, you were unique in that you were such a young kid and you were watching Turner Classic Movies. But even more unique is that you pursued it and you are out there in Hollywood right now. You're pursuing the dream, man. That's pretty amazing. What's it like out there? Is there everyone you run into doing that or not? Or, I mean, we see the cliches. What's it really like?
Right. I mean, some of the cliches are true. The traffic is horrible, but, no, it's fun. It's great. It's, I live in, North Hollywood, so, which is technically in the Valley, if anybody knows what I'm talking about there. But, so it's a little bit outside of the main part, but yeah, it's great because, like, there are a lot of people in the entertainment industry, but it's also like there's a lot of people here who just appreciate movies, and for a movie fan, it's a very unique kind of place. Like I was saying before we started, I recently saw a screening of The Red Shoes at the Egyptian Theater, and this beautiful 35mm print, and we had a guest speaker this is a surprise guest speaker, and it was Christopher Nolan.
Oh, man.
The most amazing kind of guest speaker to have. I mean, you heard everybody in the theater go, you know, when they said his name. And it was cool. And then he had his kids there to see the movie, so he watched the movie with us. But, I wanted to also mention, I saw Rear Window recently at the New Beverly Theater, so that was cool.
One of my favorites.
Yeah, I loved that episode, by the way.
Thank you.
Podcast episode. But yeah, so there's that aspect, and also, I mean, right now I'm working for the NFL and the NFL Network, in which is based in Culver City, and I'm trying to kind of move towards a lot of like archiving work, because I'm really passionate about film preservation and that sort of thing. And I'm also, I also write a lot. I work on screenplays, and also I have a blog. And so, yeah, I'm just trying to keep busy, and yeah, things are going well.
Well, that's amazing, and it's remarkable, and I really admire you for doing that. I think that's a tremendous, brave thing to do, you know, I mean, to live on one side of the country and then to go on the other side. I joke about this on Twitter, but I'm kind of not joking. It's like one of my least favorite genres of podcast is the movie podcast hosted by people who live in L.A., they go on and on about all these cool screenings they went to. And it's like, there's none of that stuff in New Jersey. And it's like, oh, yeah, I just hopped down to the New Beverly. And, oh, Quentin was there showing, you know, three of his old prints of old, you know, karate movies. I'm like, shut up. Like, I mean, I understand. I know I would be doing the same thing if I was living that life. But I can't help but just like, oh, son of a bitch.
Yeah, No, it's definitely like, it was a surprise to me. Like, because I think a lot of people have been here so long, they take it for granted. Right. And I'm like, oh, my God, this is like the coolest thing. But, yeah, it's definitely a bit different for sure.
Well, I hope one day that when I see you winning an Oscar, I'll be able to say, that guy was on my podcast that one time. I'll be able to say there that. We look forward to that. So speaking of movies, of course, which is all what we're doing here, is a little while ago I asked Ryan, give me a list. This is typically how I do it. Like, what kind of movies would you like to talk about? And, you know, Ryan's list was very diverse, very interesting, and as is sort of typical with, I think he has pretty good taste in movies, he picked something out that, again, is very atypical for someone your age to pick out. And in this case, this is the 1934 Universal horror classic, The Black Cat, which is the first pairing of Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi. This is a weird movie. Very weird movie. This is directed by Edgar G. Ulmer, who was sort of famous for being able to make movies with, you know, barely two pennies to scrape together. This was the biggest budget he ever had. Universal basically handed him a bunch of money and said, go make your movie. And this is the kind of movie you get when you let somebody as weird as Edgar G. Ulmer make a movie with big stars, big sets, and studio backing. I will give a very brief – I'll give just a very brief plot description. American honeymooners in Hungary, played by David Manners and Julie Bishop, become trapped in the home of a Satan-worshipping priest when the bride is taken there for medical help following a road accident. Now, that's a very brief description of an, as I said,
that barely scratched the surface.
Weird movie. So, what's your history with this? When did you first see this?
Oh gosh, I'm trying to remember. It wasn't when I was a kid, actually. It was definitely when I was older, because I think I was getting back into the old Universal horror movies one year. It's probably just a few years ago, and I got this set of like Bela Lugosi ones in particular, and I was trying to figure out which one to watch first, and looking up stuff online. There was some more positive stuff about The Black Cat, and so I watched it and I was kind of blown away, because it is so weird and so not your typical kind of studio movie of that era. And by the way, the Edward G. Ulmer aspect of it, do you know why he only had shoestring budgets after that?
Well, because I think he ended up having an affair with one of the wives of one of the executives of Universal, right? Isn't that the reason?
Yeah, it was a woman who was... Like, she was the wife of a guy who was Carl Laemmle's nephew. Carl Laemmle was the chief of Universal at that time.
Right.
And so he basically – and she, by the way, eventually married Edward G. Ulmer. She became a script supervisor herself. A whole interesting thing there. But like, they got married. But, yeah, he was basically blackballed from ever – working for any of the major Hollywood studios. So this was kind of his last big thing. Maybe his only big thing. And it is very odd, but I actually think it's some of the most interesting performances from Lugosi and Karloff, because I think the casting is kind of brilliant in terms of which one is playing which role. I think it's very atypical because if I was to cast, I think the first instinct to cast this movie would actually be the opposite, because Lugosi comes off as very creepy and very sinister most of the time.
How could he not?
Right. And I would argue Karloff usually comes off a little more sympathetic, even as the monster in the Frankenstein films. He always has very, like, you know, the sad eyes and especially in this, because Karloff's real voice, which he uses in this, is this very genteel, soft-spoken, like, English accent.
Yeah, it's the narrator of The Grinch, for Pete's sakes.
Right, exactly, yeah. And so I think what that does is it kind of makes the audience feel not so at ease, because you're wondering, like, well, how much should I trust what Lugosi is saying here? You know, there's that weird moment on the train where he's, like, touching Mrs. Allison's hair.
Yeah, she falls asleep, and he starts stroking her hair. And the husband notices, and he kind of just right. is like, eh, all right. He doesn't even get that bothered by
it. Yeah, there are a few weird decisions with the Allisons that we could talk about.
Well, part of that would be sharing a train car with this guy. Because he plays a character named Dr. Whitus Wondergast.
Yeah, Vertigo.
Yeah, and it's, you know, to me, it's like the minute the train conductor says, do you mind sharing a car with this guy? I'm like, get the hell out of here. This guy is like a total creep.
Yeah, he's really like, I was watching this with my girlfriend, Laura, and she was like, why would you, this guy is sending out so many red alarms. Like, why would you keep tagging along with him? What was the other thing she mentioned? Because she also said, we were also talking about the Allisons always have that thing that they did in old movies where instead of kissing, they're just sort of pressing their cheeks up against each other.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. They look like they're ready to break into song at any moment. It's like Nelson Eddy and Jeanette McDonald have wandered into a gothic horror movie. Yeah, I mean, the context of this is interesting in that this is a, you know, this is a pre-code horror movie. This is before the Hayes office got in, and this is probably one of the reasons they had it, because it was sort of like you really could do any sorts of stuff. I mean, you know, within certain limits, obviously there was, you know, social stigmas to, you couldn't have anything too crazy in the early 1930s, but there were not a set of laws of rules put in, so you could kind of get really weird and all this kind of stuff. And yet this is post Dracula, and this is before Lugosi's career really started hitting the skids, so he still looks good. I think in the early scenes where he's in the train car with Peter and Joan, he's very big. And, you know, not to cast aspersions about Bela Lugosi, because he's Bela Lugosi and I love Bela Lugosi, but you look at him in this movie, and while I think he's very interesting, you could see that his acting style, I think even by 1934, was starting to look a little old hat, because it's just so theatrical.
Yeah. It's very theatrical, which I guess makes sense, because that's sort of where he came from.
Because
I think he originated Dracula on the stage, right?
Yes.
I totally agree. Like, he's definitely he's playing very big in many moments throughout the movie. I think it does kind of fit the tone of the movie to a certain extent. But yeah, you could see how he wouldn't be able to survive in Hollywood for very long, and which unfortunately he didn't really.
Right. Yeah. So. Yeah, this is really, I mean, this, you mentioned earlier about that it's kind of an interesting reversal of what you typically see. Because, yeah, in this movie, Lugosi's character is essentially the good guy.
Right.
He's got his own problems, as we'll learn. He's got this horrible fear of black cats, hence the title. I mean, they say this is suggested by a story by Edgar Allan Poe. I mean, other than the title, it has no other connection to the story in any way.
And very lightly suggested, yeah.
I mean, and there's a scene where Wiedergast stabs a black cat, throws a knife at it just because he's scared of it, which immediately would make him pretty unsympathetic by any modern audiences. And, of course,
the stroking of... Yeah, I had to warn Laura about that one.
Yeah, the stroking of Joan's hair is very weird. But flat out, Karloff's a bad guy. I mean, he is a Satan worshiper. He gets an incredible intro. He actually gets two really incredible intros in this movie. First of all, there's the opening credit sequence where we see him from the back playing the organ. And then there's the shot where we see him laying in bed and he rises up with his light behind him. And he's just in silhouette. And it's beautiful. Yeah. I mean, it really plays up the idea of Karloff was already this legendary figure, even by 1934.
Right. Well, it's funny, like, that at that point, all you had to put on the screen was his last name.
Yep.
And audiences would immediately knew who you were talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, that shot is amazing. It's a beautiful shot. And it also adds a lot of mystery to it because, one, you're like, who is this guy? But also, who is the woman that's in the bed? Because you see there's a woman, another, obviously, pre-code thing there. They're in the same bed. But yeah, you see a woman in the bed there and you're like, okay, well who's she? What's this about? Which is kind of a disturbing reveal when you find out who it is. It's a very creepy thing. The movie deals with like a lot of taboos. And like you said, they don't always delve completely into those taboos. But even like there's some subtle stuff. There's a shot where the Allisons, I think this is after Joan Allison has been drugged and she comes into the room and after Vertigast and Prelzig have had their first confrontation and so the Allisons kiss. And there's a shot where Prelzig, which is Karloff's character, grabs the arm of like this statuette,
right?
And,
like a nude woman.
Yeah, I believe so. And like grabs it as they kiss, which is this weird thing of like, why is he doing that? You know, there's this weird kind of like sexual repression going on with this character.
Yeah. Oh, it's a beautiful shot because it's him in the, it's his arm in the statue in the foreground and it's an all silhouette. And then we see the couple in the background and it's well, yeah, I mean the opening shot of this movie is of like a train guy, like a porter carrying baggage. And this movie is all about baggage because basically what happens is I said, this couple, you know, Joan and Peter, they're on their honeymoon in Hungary. They share this train car with Wiedergast and he is a psychiatrist. And he mentions that 18 years ago, he went to war where he lost his wife. He never saw his wife again. Then he spent the last 15 years in a prison camp in Siberia, and he mentions that he is on a train to see his old friend, Prelzig, who you just mentioned, who's an Austrian architect. And this whole idea is that this couple are sort of blundering into this dynamic between these two people. And, you know, initially, Lugosi's character makes it sound like he's going to visit an old friend. But, you know, we learn very quickly that Prelzig, who is living in this fort, this giant castle built upon the remains of an old fort, which he commanded during the war, we find out that Prelzig ended up marrying Wiedergast's wife.
Right. Which is... Yeah. And not only that, but he's built this house, which is, by the way, a fantastically designed.
Oh, the Art Deco stuff in here is gorgeous.
Yeah, this beautiful Art Deco thing. But it's also like it's got a very creepy kind of stark feel to it. The production designer, his name is Charles D. Hall. And I think Ulmer himself did some of the production design. But they really did, I think, a fantastic job with that. But the fact that he's built it on the graves of all the people who died in that battle. I mean, like, talk about cold.
Yeah.
after what we found out that he sold them out to the Russians during World War I, which I think is another thing that surprised me about the movie was that it was essentially a post-war movie. I thought was kind of a brave choice to make this what could have, and somewhat is like, a, you know, a cheaper, a horror flick and not something that you'd try to go very deep with, that they're like, yeah, let's make these two characters have all this baggage that has to deal with this horrific war, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's got, it has a very sort of realistic grounding to it. I mean, you got to think about how raw these wounds must have been. I mean, this is 1934. We are less, we are what, like 15 years out from World War One. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are all guys, these are all people that remember all this stuff. And here we are having this, using it as sort of grist for the mill. And there really isn't, for this being such a you know, a gothic horror movie, it is, it keeps things fairly realistic. The only part that's even remotely, I would say, supernatural, well, there's two parts. First of all, we mentioned that Wiedergast kills the black cat. And then we see another black cat in Karloff's lap, like in a later scene. And they never explain, is that the same cat? Is it just another cat? Is the house just full of these black cats? And so that's kind of left unresolved. But then there's this later scene where Polzig and Wiedergast go downstairs, and he shows the Wiedergast his collection of dead women in glass cases, including Wiedergast's wife, which is just completely bonkers.
Right. and almost expects him to like react normally to that. It's a very that was a very surprising thing when I first saw the movie, was when he had the collection of these dead women, which that was actually something I was talking to Laura about after the movie. How many were they his wives? Were they part of the cult and then sacrificed? Like, it's a little unclear the role that all those women played in Polzig's life. But it's certainly unsettling. And and obviously Lugosi does not react well to it. But I did like there was a little speech like Polzig had to Wiedergast after revealing, you know, Karen's dead body. Mm-hmm. And he says, let's see, you say your soul was killed and that you've been dead all these years. And what of me? Did we not both die here in Marmarush 15 years ago? Are we any less the victims than those whose bodies were torn asunder? Are we not both the living dead? And now you come to me playing at being an avenging angel, childishly thirsty for my blood. It's very obviously like purple prose kind of speech, but it was very, I don't know. I thought it was well done. Maybe it was the way Karloff delivered it. I thought it was interesting, his finally like hearing this guy's perspective on the whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, there's another line Karloff has later where Wiedergast tries to use the phone, and the phone doesn't work. And Polzig says, you see, Wiedergast, even the phone is dead. So it's this is all just a bunch of ghosts. I mean, I love that they never explain how Polzig is keeping these women, because they look like they are suspended in midair in these glass cases, and they're perfectly preserved. I mean, they look, they're clearly meant to be dead, but they don't, you know, they don't look like they've been, you know, stuffed. They look like they could come alive any moment.
Yeah. They're like in frozen anime. They're like, Mr. Freeze's wife or something. They're just frozen.
Yeah, exactly.
And of course they've also got a little bit of the Bride of Frankenstein hair going on as well.
Yes, Karen has the big Bride of Frankenstein hair, and then this whole sequence is really extraordinary. And apparently was added near the end because there was some we'll get into it a little later. Is that apparently the original cut of this movie was deemed so out of control that Universal ordered Ulmer to cut a bunch of stuff and replace it with other scenes. But there's this extraordinary POV shot where we seem to all of a sudden become Polzig as we follow up the stairs, and he narrates the sequence. And it's, again, it's really extraordinary. And, you know, you could argue that maybe, and as I was a little earlier, that maybe Lugosi's a little big. But at the same time, how do you possibly handle a scene like that realistically? Because it's so absurd. It's so crazy.
Right. It is, The subject matter, like I said, his performance kind of fits the tone of the movie, because the subject matter is so overblown.
Yeah.
It's like you're watching an opera or something. It's just, it's very big. Yeah. Oh, going back to what you were saying about the violence, in the movie. And I know this movie was banned in a couple countries, when, at the time of its release. But yeah, it's pretty surprising, with like the flaying stuff at the end, between when Lugosi is basically torturing, Karloff. That was definitely a surprise to me when I watched it. Yeah.
Oh boy. Yeah, we'll get to that. Cause that gets really, that's the first time I saw this movie. I was like, whoa, you know, cause I'm just not expecting it for a 1934 movie. This movie gets even, I mean, first of all, you've already got the bizarre idea that Polzig stole Rittergast's wife away from him and is keeping her in suspended animation.
Oh, and then, yeah.
And then later on, we see Polzig go back to his bed. First of all, I love Karloff's outfits in this movie. He's got this wonderfully yeah. black smoking jacket robe, kind of like Hugh Hefner thing going on.
Right, right.
And then when he takes it off, he's in this jet black shirt and pants combo, which he never takes off. He wears it to bed. And
right, it looks like it's silk or something. Yeah,
and when he climbs into bed, we see that he is currently sleeping with Rittergast's daughter.
Yeah, it's like it's kind of creepy. It's almost incest, basically.
Yeah,
and
I mean, that's his stepdaughter.
Yeah,
he married Rittergast's wife. That's his stepdaughter, and yet he's sleeping with her. Which again, you mentioned the whole thing about getting into bed together. Like, they're not married, and yet they're climbing into bed together. Which this is, you're talking 10 years later. Nick and Nora Charles couldn't sleep in the same bed together, but here's right, Karloff right. Every getting into bed with this young girl.
Yeah. It's pretty. I love how he casually, just like as some light reading, is reading the rights of Satan or whatever, the rights of Lucifer. He's just like, all right, I'm just a little reading before I go off to bed.
It's got a little bookmark, you know, it's yeah. a little funny tassel on it, or whatever.
Which I think is when they first. That's how they first bring up the Satanism. Right. Is at that point, which apparently the Satanism was brought in as a part of the plot, because at this time Aleister Crowley was like big in the news and everybody was talking about him, so Satanism was in at the time, basically.
From what I had heard, the scene later on where Karloff starts doing this satanic ritual, he decides to sacrifice Joan. That's what gets it started. He decides once yeah. Joan comes out of her stupor, because they have a car crash, which yeah. leads them to end up ending up at Polzig's house. So he decides to sacrifice Joan and a satanic sacrifice, and he starts speaking a bunch of Latin, I believe. And I read it in a book. Yeah. I forget which book I read it. And I've read a couple books on the Universal films, but apparently they said if you translate the Latin, it's mostly gibberish. Or
yeah, it's just a bunch of random phrases, apparently.
Yeah, like pinned like with a grain of salt. Like, it's all just random right. phrases that don't mean anything. So it's kind of like an in-joke on Ulmer's part that this stuff is supposed to sound so deep and foreboding, and yet, you know, if you translate it, you're like, well, this is nothing. What is this guy's not saying anything?
Right, right. Yeah, the I did want to mention with the car right before the car crash, that driver they had is the worst tour guide in all of Hungary. He's just they're in the back seat, and all he's telling them about is all the dead bodies that have littered this field since the war, and like, oh, the blood ran through the river and blah blah blah. It's like, this is not very appealing for these two tourists.
Yeah, and it's on a lane. It's pouring rain. It's at night. I mean, it's like you.
Right.
No, you. If you had any common sense at all, you would never get into this guy's vehicle.
I'm sure Hungary was not very happy with the portrayal of their country in this movie.
Probably at the Hungary Tourism Board. Like, come on, Elmer, what are you doing? And he was Hungarian, I believe, right? Am I wrong? Is it Edgar?
Oh, he may have been. That's a good point. I'm not sure.
I think he was. So, I mean, you know, he was kind of like. Wow. And so was Lugosi, for that matter.
Yes,
you know?
Lugosi so, was, yeah.
So later on, Rittergast and Polzig decide to have this chess match, which seems yeah. to be deciding Joan's fate. And except Joan, when it, and Rittergast decides he's going to get revenge. He's going to bide his time. He's going to try and get revenge on Polzig. And he waits until Polzig starts putting together this satanic ritual. And it's interesting because when we see the ritual going on in the basement, I don't know where all these people come from, because all of a sudden there's this whole team of people in hooded robes speaking incantations. I don't know where they come from. Like, because they show you his – it seems like getting to this place is a bit of an effort. So I'm not sure to like – do they caravan up there together? Like, are they living in another room that we don't see? It's kind of interesting that they all just show up.
Right, right. Yeah, are they in the guest house or something? I don't know. That's a good point, actually. Because, yeah, well, most of the movie is a pretty small cast. It's pretty limited. But then all of a sudden, yeah, all these people show up. Not that they have big roles or anything.
No, right. It's interesting you said that it is a tiny cast. It really mostly is just Lugosi and Karloff with David Manners. And, of course, David Manners had a long history of dealing with these guys because he was in Dracula. Yeah. He faced off with Lugosi and The Mummy with Boris Karloff. So, I mean, now he's faced off against both of them. And I was doing some reading on this movie after I watched it again, and there was a couple of really outstanding articles getting into the themes of these things. And one person suggested that because David Manners is an American here, and he's an idiot. He seems completely unaware of the danger he's in.
Right.
I mean, he's in this house with these two creepy guys, and he just seems like kind of blithely going through everything. And then later on, during this really amazing climax where Reader Gass finally decides to try and get revenge on Polzig, and not to give it away, but what the hell, this movie's 80 years old. I think we can – we're all right with that.
Yeah, I've probably given away too much already. I was jumping all over the place before.
Reader Gass tries to rescue Joan after he has attacked Polzig, and David Manners' character sees that. And he mistakes Wiedergast for trying to harm Joan, and he shoots Wiedergast.
Yeah, it's a bit of an overreaction. Yeah,
it's like, you idiot, you know. And the stuff I was reading,
as if he wasn't stupid enough already. Yeah,
right,
yeah,
exactly. And I was reading about people saying that this was maybe Edgar Ulmer and the other author of the story, Peter Brurich, their comment on the U.S. in World War I, that we just sort of blundered in, caused a bunch of trouble, and got out and.
Right, sort of the interventionism.
And just paid no price for intervening in other people's affairs.
Right. No, that's a good point. I didn't even think of that, but yeah, because they do seem so out of place. And actually, not only does he do harm there, but Joan Allison does harm when she reveals all this information to Karen, the younger Karen, the
daughter. Yeah.
Daughter that Polzig is sleeping with, and then, like you said, I guess we don't have to worry about spoilers. But
if you haven't seen it in the last 80 years, I think the spoiler warning is hereby rescinded.
Yeah, she reveals, you know, oh, your father's alive, he's looking for you, and of course Polzig's right there, hears it, and then kills Karen, and it's. Kind of indirectly, because Joan decided to take matters into her own hands and solve the situation and kind of made it worse.
Right. Yeah, these two really don't take much care into what's going on. I mean, Karloff is so creepy and Lugosi's so creepy, but you never get the sense that David Manners has any inkling. And of course, again, that's why it was directed. And there's the final scene where it even underscores that. But I think this movie is visually striking and tonally very striking, but what really puts it over the top is during the final sequence where Wiedergast manages to get their upper hand on Polzig, and he straps him to this crucifix that they're using for the satanic rituals, and he tells Polzig that he is going to flay him alive.
Right.
And he runs over to this tray of surgical instruments. And I love it. There's a great – Lugosi actually like looks at a couple of them before picking the right one, which is really like a funny detail. And then, of course, we don't see it, but we see a silhouette of Wiedergast hacking away at Karloff's body.
And we hear like the screams and everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's a part where Lugosi's over-the-topness really works, because he's taking such – when he's describing what he's going to do to him, he's taking such relish in like telling him, I'm going to, you know, slowly cut away at your flesh and blah. You know, he's so into it. and he's like has this big grin on his face. And even though he's, like you said, he's basically the hero of the movie, he comes off as really frightening in that part.
He's completely, Karloff, his hair is all must. Yeah, he's completely lost it.
Yeah. Oh yeah. That finale is really interesting. And like you said, they had are constantly using, this is something also that would not have happened post Hays Code, which is all the use of the crucifixes, which are all tilted. Yep. You know, they're all on their side for this, these satanic rituals. And I cannot imagine that would have been allowed post July 1934, no. You know?
Yeah. It's, I mean, it, and we can't, so in the, during the final sequence, Karloff isn't killed. He literally is flayed, but we never get to see him because obviously they couldn't show him. So we see a lot of Lugosi right. talking to Polzig and telling him this and that. Now, apparently, according to rumor, Ulmer did shoot some scenes, one of which showed a half flayed, I'm using that word a lot, but what else, you know, how many times do I get to talk about it? A half flayed Karloff wandering across the floor. And some books have said that's nonsense. They never would have shot that, you know, because they know they never would have. So that seems to be one of those rumors that people wish was true because you just be like, boy, imagine what that would have looked like at 1934 level effects. But they apparently Ulmer showed this to Universal and Universal said, no. And they made it cut a lot of stuff out of it and they had to replace it with some more character driven stuff. And he said he ended up adding the scene down in the basement where we see all the people and the women in the glass cases and stuff. So if anything, you made it even kind of more perverse. Right. And it ends with both Polzig and Weirdgast dying. And the final moments of the movie is our couple doing the, as you mentioned, the cheek-to-cheek thing. And the whole bit is that he's an author. He's an author. And he reads a review of his book, which, of course, he has based this new horror novel off of what happened to him. And he reads a review, and the review is basically saying, this book is completely unrealistic. And him and his wife look at each other like, you know, almost do an eye roll. Can you believe it? Kind of thing.
Yeah, like you almost expect like a little wah, wah, wah. Yeah.
And these two seem to have suffered nothing emotionally for the absolute whirlwind they just went through.
In reality, like, these people would be in therapy for the rest of their lives. But they just kind of brush it off like, oh, whatever, you know, what a crazy honeymoon.
Yeah, I can't wait till we tell our folks what happened. We saw a guy get flayed alive, and there was a Satan worshippers, and this castle blew up, and there was, there was some dead people in cases. There was a big mongoloid henchman that tried to kill me.
The henchman. The henchman was interesting as well, yeah.
There's a couple of goonish henchmen in here that are fun to look at as well.
I also like that David Hemmings' character. David Manners, not David Hemmings. He wasn't in this.
That would have been amazing.
He gets all judgy about the job of an architect. And he, you know, not to look down on authors, like I write myself, but like, really? You're going to start throwing stones in glass houses here? That he's like, oh, an architect. I guess the world needs them, you know. It's very weird. Like, why would he react that way?
Yeah, he's not the most sympathetic character in this movie. I mean, there's really no, I mean, I guess it's Joan is the most sympathetic, although she's pretty doofusy too, because you just mentioned
she's just kind of passed out for most of it.
She ends up getting Karen killed, but yeah, I mean, you really, you know, Lugosi's our hero, and then of course when he starts skinning someone alive, you're like, yeah, I think he's kind of lost my sympathy. Although of course I didn't like him once he stabs the black cat. That's
a tough one. Although I do think Lugosi's probably the most sympathetic character because you understand where he's coming from. Even the part where he starts to torture Karloff. I mean, he did just see that Karloff killed his daughter.
That's true.
You know? So, like, it's not excusable, but it's like, all right, well, I get where he's coming from, you know.
Good to know, Ryan, if you guess you ever get really mad at somebody.
I'm not excusing torture here, of course.
I'm not saying you deserve to be flayed alive. I'm just saying. So, okay. One other thing that I thought was worth mentioning is that this plot, in terms of a married couple wanders in to this sort of boarding house, not boarding house, but like a hotel in this other case, but sort of wanders into this cult of Satan worshippers, bears a striking resemblance to Manos, the Hands of Fate. I don't believe for one moment the makers of Manos, Hal Warren, I believe is his name, was remaking this movie at all. But nevertheless, there is some similarities there.
There's a connection there.
There's a connection. It's the honeymooners, and they wander into this thing. Now, it's kind of funny because, you know, the Hayes office, you know, this was the kind of movie that the Hayes office was like, you can't do this. This movie was Universal's biggest moneymaker of 1934.
Yeah, it was huge. I mean, I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that it was Karloff and Lugosi.
Right.
And it was their first pairing. But yeah, this made them a lot of money. And it's funny that it's not as – I mean, I guess because it's so strange, but it's – you know, you don't see it in like the big sets of like the old Universal horror movies. You know, you don't see it next to The Bride of Frankenstein and stuff.
There's no iconic monster to play off of. I mean, Karloff looks pretty weird in his robes, but there's no Frankenstein, there's no Phantom of the Opera, there's no Creature of the Black Lagoon to sort of hang this on. It really is just sort of this drawing room thing where, I mean, you could have done this as a really elaborate play if you had wanted to. I mean, because it's really just a couple of sets that go back and forth. But yeah, it is, and I think... You know, I mean, the classic monster movies, I think they have gained a certain level of, I don't think it's true. They've gained a certain level of class. I mean, the AFI puts a couple of them on their top 100 films of all time. And even though those movies, the Dracula and Frankenstein, they have their own, you know, they're pretty blood-soaked in their own way. They're kind of safe for kids.
Right.
Because they're just not that intense. But you would never show this to a kid. I think if you were an adult, you'd be like, this movie's friggin' sick. I'm not showing this to my 9-year-old that likes The Bride of Frankenstein.
Right. That's true. Yeah. This kind of is a little bit too real with its horror almost. Yeah. Like, you know, there's with supernatural monsters, you can at least put a level of distance from it. You know, you can kind of put up a bit of a wall and be like, okay, well, that's a fantasy thing.
Yeah.
Like you said, this one's pretty light on actual fantasy. As bonkers as the plot is, it's light on actual fantasy.
Yeah, I mean, as I'm thinking about it, it's like, as much as I don't like the fact that he kills the cats, you could almost argue that maybe those cats aren't even really there. Those are just figments. Because Lugosi so overreacts. At one point, he gets so scared of a cat, he falls to a wall. yeah. You know, I mean, it's like, talk about a big reaction. So you might even say, you know what, those are just in his mind anyway. They're like, it's hard to really pinpoint any of this as genuinely happening or not. You know, it's just such a strange thing. And it's kind of an interesting idea that, you know, what a filmmaker will show you when given free rein. You know, it's like they gave Ulmer all these resources, the two of the biggest stars that Universal had on the lot, probably their big, Karloff is probably their biggest star at this point. And you give him a bunch of money, you don't supervise him, and you just let him make his movie, and this is what he gives you, you know? And you're like, well, that tells you a lot about Edgar Ulmer, you know, that this is the movie he wanted to make. It's kind of like with Orson Welles. It was like Orson Welles had one shot to make the movie he always wanted to make, and he made Citizen Kane. Edgar Ulmer was like, this is what I want to do. I want to make this weird-ass story.
Right. Yeah, him and – well, apparently the screenwriter is credited as – Peter Rorick. It was one of the pen names for George Carroll Sims, who also wrote under a different pen name for pulp novels as Paul Kane. There's a particular novel that he's kind of known for that. But yeah, he was kind of interesting writer in his own. I mean, I don't know much about him, but he definitely. I guess wanted to tell this story as well.
I'm trying to imagine them pitching this to Karloff and Lugosi. Yeah. You know, like, hey, we're going to do this, and you're gonna be sleeping with Lugosi's wife and daughter. Like, they might. I mean, you know, it gives. I don't know. I mean, it kind of gives me a new view of these guys. I mean, I think Lugosi would have taken whatever part they offered him at this point. Probably even this early, he was still a little like, all right, I don't have. You know, But
although I guess if you had offered this to Karloff 10 years after this, he would have said no.
Yeah, right. He had a lot more kind of to protect.
Yeah, yeah. But I don't know.
He looks great. I mean, he's really memorable. I love his close cropped hair.
Yeah, and he so looks thin. Really cool. He's very, he has that very gaunt appearance, like that shot you were talking about where he comes up in the bed. He it's like he has this giant head and such a thin body. It's almost like some sort of a marionette or something.
Yeah, well, that's funny you say that. I never really thought of it, but you're right. Yeah, he does have that. He cuts quite a figure. He really does. Yeah. And I'm looking at him here now as we're talking, and he's coming down in his satanic robes. He looks pretty cool. I actually, I'm kind of like maybe saying, if they wanted to market this as a monster movie, they maybe could have gotten away with it, because he looks like a super low rent Doctor Strange or something. Yeah, he's got the sash and it looks pretty cool. Look.
The hair is like just so, yeah.
Oh, it's pacing on. I love the Satanists. The Satanists are fun because they're all kind of like young people. You're like, where did they find all these people? You know, like where did this club of Satanists? I have a soft spot for movies about satanic cults. I don't know why. There's just something fascinating about that. You could find all these, you know. I've had difficult times in my life, you know, fielding enough people like to do volleyball. You know, and yet, how do you find, like 20 to 30 people that are like, oh, yeah, I'm a Satanist. Yeah, you too? Oh, yeah, awesome. Like, how do you do that?
Send out a Facebook invite. Yeah.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Which, by the way, have you ever seen, it's a movie with Christopher Lee. It has like two different titles. I think one is like The Devil Rides something.
Rides Out?
The Devil Rides Out, yeah, that was it.
I have seen that, yes.
Oh, okay, yeah. Very, very interesting satanic cult movie.
Yeah, that's a whole other genre. I would love to almost do like a whole show just about the devil cult genre, because that really, it was big, and except you talked about Aleister Crowley, who was a real guy, and he was big in the 30s, and then sort of satanic stuff came back in the 70s, that was a big thing then, and stuff like that. So,
right.
Yeah, it's always there's something to me, as you mentioned, it's easier to be reserved, to get, have a reserve when you've got a monster, you've got a mummy running around. But to me, this is creepier that you might have just regular people who, you know, you might work with, you might share a desk with them, share an office with them. And then when they go home at night, they're, you know, doing incantations to Beelzebub. It's pretty freaking weird.
Right. Oh, one more thing about, Polzig, by the way, he apparently Ulmer loosely based the character off of Fritz Lang.
Ooh, okay.
he knew Fritz Lang through the German cinema scene, and Lang was apparently a little bit of a taskmaster and not an easy guy to work with. So. it's a little bit of a dig at him, I think.
Wow, I guess Lang got the last laugh because he kept working in Hollywood, and
that's true.
Ulmer was making super cheap jack movies for Poverty Row later on in his career. So yeah, this is really a remarkable movie. And even though Ryan and I both have given you everybody like all the details, it's still absolutely worth watching because it's just it's just so surreal, and it's short. I mean, this movie's I think like 68 minutes. I mean, you know, it's basically the length of a Game of Thrones episode, and it's visually striking. It's so weird to look at. It's neat to see Karloff and Lugosi kind of in their prime squaring off against each other. It's got a great scene of a secret passage. That's another thing I'm a sucker for, is things with secret passages where you can, you turn a knob and it moves a wall over and stuff like that. And it's Edgar Ulmer at his sort of finest. I mean, I've seen some of Ulmer's other movies. Are you familiar with any of the other ones they did, like Detour and
I haven't Man seen Detour yet. I really No, yeah, I need to dive more into his stuff because, some of those I'm really interested in seeing.
Yeah, Detour is on YouTube. The whole thing's on YouTube. And I think it's a really good movie, but it is so cheap that it does kind of, you know, you can sort of see it there. You're like, well, man, he didn't have any money to do anything. You know what I mean? And so this is what he could do when he had some resources. And, you know, he said he had some real skills. And obviously, as you mentioned, that he stayed with this woman for the rest of his life. Obviously, you know, he short-circuited his career by sleeping with the Mrs. Lamel, but he obviously loved her because they stayed together the rest of his life. So, you know, I don't know whether he would say it was worth it or not, but At least the relationship lasted.
Right. And he's apparently, you know, he wasn't the type of guy to give a lot of interviews or anything like that. So there's not a lot directly from him about what happened or with any of his movies. But yeah, like you said, considering they did stay together until his death. And he didn't seem to be a guy with a lot of regrets.
Yeah, he passed away in 1972, which is, I mean, he lived long enough to kind of for people to start revering him, like discovering his films. But of course, a little too early to where, you know, the stuff could start coming out on, you know, home video, although he would have been too old probably for that anyway. But I mean, I think it's, you know, he's kind of like an Ed Wood figure that he sort of died before he really had a chance for people to really come back and discover him and go back, wow, this is some amazing stuff he's doing here. So. Yeah, it's a really interesting movie, and I'm glad that you recommended it. I was happy to have a chance to rewatch it because it's a really interesting movie.
Yeah, no, I was glad to talk about it because, not a lot of people have seen it, and so I haven't gotten to talk this much about it for sure. And it's a great Halloween movie, too. It's a good one.
It is a great – that was something else, too. When you sent me your list, and I was like, oh, I always like to do some stuff for Halloween, and it is a good Halloween movie because it's just creepy and weird and – all kinds of bizarre stuff. So, well, Ryan, like, thank you so much for coming on, man. I'm as I said at the top of the show, I really admire your willingness to go out there and do it. I think that's just phenomenal, and I'm very envious. You got to go to see The Red Shoes on the big screen with Christopher Nolan. But I had a lot of fun talking to you, and it was great catching up with you.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. Thanks a lot.
Where can people find you on the internet? You mentioned that you do some writing. Where is that blog?
Right, so that it's a fairly new blog. It's only a few posts so far, although one of them is on horror movies. It's called Cinema in Context. So the URL is cinemaincontext.wordpress.com.
Very cool. So. And we will have that in the show notes. So, again, thank you so much for coming on. I look forward to having you on again. And like I said, I wish you all the good luck in the world out there.
Thank you very much.
All right, everybody. All right. Well, thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this scary episode of the Film & Water podcast as we count down to Halloween. So, of course, you can listen to all the back episodes on this show over on our network site, fireandwaterpodcast.com. And we talk about movies over on the show's Twitter feed, which is at Film & Water Pod. So until next week, that's a wrap.
Sometimes these cases take strange forms. The victim becomes, in a sense, mediumistic. A vehicle for all the intangible forces in operation around her.
Sounds like a lot of supernatural baloney to me.
Supernatural, perhaps. Baloney, perhaps not.